I come to this as an architectural historian and a church member and a session member here, not as an expert on liturgy or even church architecture in particular. So I have to do my apologies first and suggest that what I will do is, especially tonight, be giving you a survey from an architectural historian's standpoint of the history of church architecture. This is the broad survey night. It may also be one of the longer of the talks that I'm going to give. I hope not too long. We'll be looking at material that we'll revisit in my subsequent talks and that some of the others will be visiting in various other ways, just drilling down a little bit more in the next couple of days. On Christmas Eve, 1699, the recently completed and controversial Brattle Street Church in Boston was dedicated to the Lord's service. Minister Benjamin Coleman chose a standard text for the dedicatory sermon. He chose 2 Chronicles chapter 6, which describes the dedication of the temple built by Solomon in Jerusalem. Brattle Street Church, which has long since disappeared, has played a significant role, however, in American church architecture. The building departed from the severe austerity of Puritan meeting houses of its time by including something quite shocking, an end tower with a spire or a steeple, in the manner of fashionable Anglican churches in the mother country. Historian Marion Donnelly noted one other thing that was a little unusual, and I'm not certain that he's right, but it seems reasonable. He said that it is to this church that the documents tell us that the word church was first applied in New England rather than the word meeting house. This is particularly interesting, Donnelly notes, given the choice of the sermon text. In verse 18, the chronicler quotes Solomon, who, after building one of the most glorious temples in history, asks, "But will God really dwell on earth with men? The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I have built?" The problem of church architecture, references to Solomon's temple are commonplace in the dedicatory sermons, I'll go back there, dedicatory sermons of churches. References to Solomon's temple are also commonplace in the history of church architecture, as we shall see. But for now, I want to highlight what might be the central problem regarding church architecture. The problem, as I see it, is... should the church building be considered a dwelling place for God? Another related question. How do we build a place for corporate worship, for the corporate worship of a God who cannot be contained by the highest heavens? I'd like to suggest there are two views of what such a building might be. One of the views is... how a building that is used for the setting of architectural... Christian worship, how it should be viewed. One of the views is it should be viewed as a temple, which is to say, the house of God. The other view is that it should be seen as a meeting house. A temple, as it is commonly understood, is the house of God. It is a sacred place. Forgive my inexpert ancient philology here. I looked this up. The primary word as temple in the Old Testament that I saw was tekel, or however it's pronounced for those ministers who study this, which comes, apparently, the lexicon tells us, from an Akkadian word, which means palace, or house, or dwelling place. And I also looked up the Greek word, naos, which is the word that we use in architecture to describe the Greek temple, which the root word meaning of which also means dwelling place. So dwelling place, house of God, seems to be the meaning of most of the ancient words that we would translate as temple. A temple in antiquity is, therefore, a house of God. Now, from my area where I have more expertise, from architecture, this seems to be true. That is, buildings that are built as temples are built as houses for a god. Architectural historians have long noted this across cultures. So, take the ancient ziggurat at Ur. That's the great construction that you see there, an artificial mountain on top of which used to be the house of the mountain, the house on the mountain, the house of the moon goddess Nana. This is probably the best preserved of all the ancient Mesopotamian ziggurats. Or, maybe more familiarly, here we have the house of Athena, the Parthenon. it's a temple, but consummately it was conceived of, architecturally so, as the house of the goddess. Note, of course, the use of columns and an entablature and a pediment, the very language that this room is made of, which will be seen as we move through this material. Or, just for comparison, note, as I'm sure you know, that the Romans picked up on what the Greeks had done when they built their temples and made their own version of a house for the gods, often for multiple gods with the Romans. So there's a typology. There's a temple typology that can be found and has been studied extensively. And, of course, that typology is also related to what we know archaeologically and from the Bible of the form that Solomon's temple had taken, a rectangular box with a sacred place and a most sacred place and a porch and a place to have sacrifices outside. It's the same basic arrangement as the Parthenon, with some very important differences, of course, the lack of columns around and the fact that there was no image on the inside but the Ark of the Covenant instead. Note also that there is another tradition. There's a parallel tradition, a kind of secondary tradition of making temples. That is the circular or central planned temple. The Greeks did it. The Romans did it. The Chinese do it. We have central planned temples in the history of houses for the gods. And as we'll see, we also have central planned and sometimes circular church buildings as well. We say this in architecture class, that there are longitudinal buildings, longitudinal churches, longitudinal temples, and then there are central planned temples. And these constitute the basic blocks of a typology from which you can build just about any building in the history of architecture. So, temples, that's what ancient temples were, but that's not our subject tonight. We're going to look at churches. And let me say, first of all, that a church, in the earthly sense, is not a temple. We'll look at some language here again. You all know this, I think, in this crowd, that the Greek New Testament word for church primarily is the word ekklesia, which refers more generically to an assembly, literally a group of people who've been called out, and was used to describe Greek assemblies of various sorts. So there's the did we lose sound? No? It's just turned down. Okay. So we have the ecclesia, but in English we have the word church. I looked this up in the Oxford English Dictionary. It's a little bit murky, actually. But apparently the word church derives from a Greek combination of words, somehow something like kyriakon oikon. I know at least enough to know the word house and the word for the Lord is there. In other words, the house of the Lord is probably at the root etymologically of our word church in English. In other words, it's not the same as the as ecclesia. It's closer to, but not quite the same as the root meaning of the word for temple. It's one of the reasons why the word church was avoided by certain Reformed Christians, as we'll see, to describe buildings and not to describe the church as the ecclesia. Theologians tell us, of course, that that the ecclesia, the church, comes in two categories. It's the same church. There's the universal body of Christ, and then there is the local church, the governed and assembled body of professing Christians. For architectural historians, there is the third use of the word church, which is used as a surrogate, as kind of a stand-in to represent the building. And, of course, we use this word all the time in common speech. The church building that is our subject is something that represents the ecclesia, represents the church, and serves the church, two themes that we'll try to develop in subsequent talks. So the question is, how is this best accomplished? How is it that the church building serves the ecclesia? As I've said, as a title of our talk suggests, it seems to me from architectural history that there are two texts that can be taken. On the one hand, the church is seen as intrinsically sacred, as more as a temple. On the other hand, it's seen as more profane, less more secular, and therefore as a meeting house. Another polarity that we could use is that the church is seen as more by some as being a transcendent type, a transcendent building, and by others as a secular or immanent type. Let's try to illustrate that by running through, I'll try to do this with some speed, but it'll take us some time, the entire history of church architecture, and see where we see temples and see where we find meeting houses. And we'll notice as we do this that there are twists and turns, and if we get too far behind, I'll just skip some stuff. We could start, of course, with the New Testament. That's changed again. That is, we can learn something about church architecture in the book of Acts, where we're told in chapter 2 that they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. Two places we see here. We see the temple courts, and we see homes being mentioned. And, of course, we know that the earliest church, the New Testament church, is meeting in not any one kind of place, but in several. Other literary sources and archaeology together tell us that the early church, the New Testament church, met in synagogues, in marketplaces, public meeting halls, cemeteries, and holy places, martyrial spots, and of course, house churches. Oh, that was my slide to illustrate the ecclesia, right, who is not yet with their church building. Here is an example of what an early church may have looked like. This one doesn't appear to have played that role, but here is a relatively early synagogue, and you can see in it the forms that would have been typical to a rather palatial Hellenistic house type with a courtyard. And in that, within that, is a series of rooms that was used as a synagogue. Down here, there's an atrium, a forecourt, an open space with columns, and at the end, a semicircular or apsidal space. That's mostly all we know about this building that is largely in ruins. But it may have been rooms like this that some Christian assemblies had met before they were no longer welcome in a synagogue. Another example of a church would be the house church, the Domus Ecclesiae. I show here the most famous and almost the only example from early antiquity of a building which has been specifically identified as being used as a house church. This one in the site of in Syria, in Dura Europis, was modified. We have paintings, we have a baptismal font, and we have rooms that we know were used for certain purposes. It's a typical Greco-Roman house plan. It has an open courtyard or an atrium in the center. Over here, turn this way. It has a room designated for the baptistry, and there's a little pool here, and a room that was used for communion, for the agape feast over here, and a separate room for meeting, the largest room, all off of the atrium. How typical was this? We know that the separation of these uses was common, but we don't really have many other examples archaeologically to compare with. The big story in church architecture is the invention or the adoption of the basilica. A basilica is a Roman building type. It seems to have been chosen. We don't know exactly why or how, but part of the story is what was not chosen. That is, when Christianity was legalized and it was becoming more more acceptable in the early days before Constantine and then after Constantine, we find that there's evidence of these basilicas and not evidence of buildings that look like temples. For whatever reason, the temple, that is the Roman temple, a religious building, a typology that was readily available, is not adopted by the Christians, but the basilica, which is mostly a secular building type, was. One reason is Greco-Roman temples, right, like the Parthenon or the Maison Carrée that you saw before, wouldn't make very good churches. They were dark and they weren't set up for public meetings. They were meant to house a sacred image on the inside. But of course, secondarily, they were associated with pagan religion, and there may have been a concerted decision to avoid this association. The basilica, as we said, we don't know exactly where it comes from typologically in the history of Roman architecture. It's a big hall, often divided into three parts so that you can get light into the center. Like this room, we would have columns, and we have a tall space and short spaces on the side. And you would find this in almost any Roman city, generally off of the main plaza or the forum. Sometimes there would be many of these. And often, as if this grand example that we have in ruined form in North Africa, we have apses again, those semicircular spaces at either end. It would have been entered on the long sides, not on the short side. Some basilicas were used as law courts, and so we'd have trials there, and the apse would be used as a tribunal. This is the judges would sit there. And in the late empire, of course, basilicas were used as appearance halls for the emperor, who would preside in the apse and be met by the citizens. It may be that this symbolism of the law court or of the imperial audience hall may have been significant in choosing the basilica as a building type for Christian churches. The most famous basilica that we know that is a church is one that doesn't exist anymore, and that would be Old St. Peter's, the church that was built on Mons Vaticanus in the Vatican Hill, specifically on over the site of the burial of St. Peter. This, then, is a secular building type, the basilica, which is now extended with an atrium in front, an open courtyard, and a gateway raised on a platform, probably rather plain on the outside. At this time, with extra aisles, it's a five-aisled, two aisles on either side of the nave, the central aisle, basilica, very grand. And then if you follow along the axis, you get to a crossing space, it's known as a transept, which seems to be over the place of several burials, including Peter's, which is lined up right there where the apse is that terminates. We have the beginnings of the cruciform plan here. We don't understand exactly why or how that's happening, but it becomes a type that will be followed for the rest of architectural history. So here we have the basilica, explicitly not a temple, right? Except that the descriptions tell us that that the builders of St. Peter's proportioned it after the Temple of Solomon. We don't completely understand what they meant by that, but that's what they said, so we take them at their word. And then, of course, it marks the spot, a sacred spot, so there's the idea of the sacred is implicit in this building, not to mention the fact that it's this lavishly, the descriptions of it are quite lavish. Here's one from the 4th century that says, Constantine Augustus built the Basilica of Blessed Peter the Apostle and laid there the coffin and the body, and enclosed it with bronze and set porphyry columns and a vaulted apse in the basilica with gold and silver lampstands. And he goes on and on, talking about the gold and silver and the mosaics and the beautiful things that were in this church, which no longer exists, of course. So there's St. Peter's. That would have been an extraordinary basilica in the history of churches, the largest by far. Far away from it was the Lateran Basilica and several others also built in this Constantinian period. If you want to see what an early Christian basilica looked like, you have to look to a period somewhat later. Here we have one in the city of Ravenna, San Apollinario in Classe, which is in pretty good condition as to the way that it was in the early 6th century. You notice how plain it is on the outside. It was made of brick. You can see the shorter roof, the lower roofs over the aisles and the higher roof over the nave. You can see that there's a narthex, an entry porch, before that. There's also a bell tower, which has been added. The church is plain on the outside and the opposite on the inside, probably more spectacular than it is today. Covered many of the walls with mosaics, beautiful columns, Greco-Roman columns, marble, I guess you could say, a wide aisle that leads then to an apse with a raised platform and then mosaics over that include the cross and include the bishop with sheep representing the pastor and representing Christ and even God the Father above that. The dome, the quarter dome in the apse certainly has the connotations of a dome of heaven, symbolizing that we're entering into the city of God, into the heavenly realm of some kind. So this idea of being plain on the outside and pure on the inside, one medieval writer says, reminds us of ourselves as Christians, that we are not to adorn ourselves with finery on the outside, but we are to take care of how we appear on the inside. Right? It's a metaphor that's applied in this case to architecture. Well, all right, in our quick survey, we'll jump now from there. Our time-wise, we're in the same time as Santa Maria, Santa Apollinare, to what's happening in the Eastern Empire. Something rather dramatic, as you know, the innovation that takes place under Justinian of combining the basilica with the central planned church. We don't know where it came from, but this great pile of a building, one of the great churches in world history, culminates at this great dome that you see appears on the outside and beautifully on the inside as well. Hagia Sophia, Holy Wisdom, is a church that clearly leans toward the temple side of our equation as we're making this survey. Several reasons for this. The interior, which of course is not even close to the state that it would have been with Justinian, having suffered through iconoclastic riots in the 10th century and near obliteration of all the decoration in 1453 as it was turned into a mosque, nevertheless is still a very impressive building. It had galleries. It had an elaborate protocol that would have separated the various peoples who would have attended a worship service. There was great emphasis on the imperial entrance and on the priesthood as being separate from the people. Ceremony was very elaborate. Ritual was very elaborate. Mystery seems to be the key to the design. That is, it's a complicated building, and if you could have seen it in its day with flickering lamps on the mosaic, it would be a building so overwhelming that one couldn't understand it. That's actually what amounts to what Procopius and others had said about it when they saw it. But that mystery is solved. It reveals itself with the dome of heaven, suspended by light, as Procopius mentions. A 10th century Russian prince went to a worship service there and he said this: "We knew not whether we were in heaven or earth, for on earth there is no such splendor, no such beauty. We were at a loss as how to describe it. We only knew that God dwells there among men." There's our phrase, right? It's a temple. God dwells in this space. Well, all right, I'll save you. I'm not going to go through early medieval history or Carolingian or Romanesque. I'm going to take you now to the Gothic in the West. Increased ritual and mystery occurs in the Christian West as it does in the East. Not quite in the same way, and maybe not as quickly. The basilica is transformed by the 12th century so that it's almost unrecognizable, but this, the building type remains. It becomes now the embodiment, the church building becomes the embodiment of the city of God. Transcendence is in ascendance, we might say, and it becomes the paramount reason for building. We could listen to one of the great Gothic cathedral builders, perhaps, according to some, the inventor of Gothic, the abbot Suger of Saint-Denis outside of Paris. Suger, who transformed his own abbey church at Saint-Denis, says that it is Jesus Christ in whom all the building, whether spiritual or material, groweth into one holy temple of the Lord, in whom we too are taught to be builded together for a habitation of God through the Holy Spirit. And because we are builded in God in a spiritual way, so it is that we build our material churches to reflect God's work in us. In other words, the material reflects, embodies the spiritual for Suger. And he goes on and describes how this happens in many ways. The Gothic cathedral is a world set apart, a place transformed. It was the heavenly city of God, and in it you would find crowned the Queen of Heaven. This is described by those who have been to these churches. I can show you to her, to you. It was an enclosed sanctuary. It was a place where God appeared and where the Virgin Mary would appear, as the painter has shown us, Jan van Eyck, in this beautiful painting that uses the Gothic cathedral as the setting for heaven itself. Or take another Gothic example. This is the interior of the church of the beautiful later Gothic church of Saint-Chapelle in Paris that was built under Louis IX, Saint Louis. He built this church, having come back from the Crusades, with great glory and more than glory, with the crown of thorns that Jesus wore, or allegedly so. And with this great treasure, he decided he would build a building glorious enough to contain this this relic. So the building is itself a reliquary. It is a holy building that contains an holy object, very much in the manner of a temple. Or take the outside of a Gothic cathedral, such as we see here at Reims from the 13th century. All Gothic cathedrals in France tended to go like this, right? They were twin-towered affairs with three doors. The twin-towered door on a cathedral, it's a gate. If you look at architectural history, it's a gate. It's a city gate. If you read Abbot Suger, it is a city gate. It's a gate not into the city on earth. It's a gate into the city of God. It's described that way. The painter Hans Memling understood this when he used a Gothic cathedral to show what heaven looks like. Here we go through the gates, and then we pass by the saints and angels who are collected on the facade, and that's what you do when you go into a Gothic church, is the heavenly host are there. A great cloud of witnesses greets you as you move through these doors filled with meaning. But, of course, all of this opulence, these grand and great ideas, were not universally accepted throughout the Middle Ages for what they were. There were criticisms of opulence and lavish display, and criticisms of undue spiritualizing of material things. One of the great critics, of course, is Bernard of Clairvaux, who levied sharp criticism at the opulence of churches of his day. He was, in fact, contemporary of Abbot Suger, and they had a debate running between them. He was very much of the opposite persuasion. "Tell me, O pontiffs," he says, "what is gold doing in the sanctuary?" in his famous letter criticizing the Benedictine monks at a different place, actually. Bernard is one of the founders of the Cistercian movement, which repudiated the opulence and the sacral approach to all things religious, including architecture. And the Cistercians will go on to build buildings that are quite simple, barn-like in their forms. Maybe not completely like a Puritan meeting house, but this is our early Reformed movement, I think we would say. Or take the Franciscans a little later, the Order of Beggars, whose purpose it was to go out and to preach the gospel and to meet the needs of the needy and to renounce all worldly things and to build abbey churches like this one in Florence, the greatest of all Franciscan churches, the Church of Santa Croce. Santa Croce is a pretty lavish place today, as you see it, but think about it stripped of, on the side aisles, those all of those famous burials, and there are some famous ones there, like Galileo, etc. If you took those away, they wouldn't have been there. The building is essentially a barn. It's a big barn with a wooden roof, very simple, big pointed arches. It was thought to be that way. It's just that the Franciscans actually had more money than they knew what to do with, so they made it the biggest barn ever, and they adorned it with a lot of decoration. But that was their goal. They had money because the Florentines were rich and were feeling guilty, so they gave them a lot of money. The Renaissance was many things. It was, on the one hand, a return to a kind of simplicity that had perhaps been lacking in the opinions of some. It was also, of course, the time when humanist scholars cried out ad fontes, to the sources, and went back to find the originals of literature, the originals of architecture and the arts. When they went back to find the originals, one thing that architectural historians have just been waking up to is that antiquity for them was Greece and it was Rome, but it was also the early Christian period. This was part of antiquity, and there's no doubt but that Brunelleschi was reviving early Christian architecture when he built these rational, simple, colonnaded basilicas such as San Lorenzo that you see here. Now, let me throw in another twist, however. One of the great Florentine humanist scholars of the Renaissance was a guy named Leon Battista Alberti. Alberti was a brilliant man. He was also a priest. He's ordained. He works for the Pope, but he loves architecture, and so he writes a book in the middle of the 15th century on architecture, the first book to be written on this subject since antiquity. It's lengthy, it's erudite, it's written in Latin, and in it he talks about churches, but he never calls them churches in Latin. He calls them, he uses the singular, templum. He always calls it a temple. And it's a little confusing. It seems as though it would have been confusing to his readers, to the Pope, who would have read it, and others. He seems insistent on making the church seem like the temple of Roman times. He doesn't do that just linguistically, however. This is his famous San Andrea, built toward the end of his career in Mantua, which is a very important building because here it is that the basilica has turned into a temple. Explicitly so. There it is, a big temple front. It doesn't look like the Pantheon or the Parthenon exactly, but it's the first clear and explicit use of a temple front on a church. And just walk the streets of Savannah and you'll realize how important a move that was. But what does it mean? Why was he using something that the early Christians apparently had been reluctant to use, that is the Roman, Greco-Roman temple type? No one's quite answered that yet, but we'll explore it. A little more explicit yet, right? How about this building, one of the most famous from the Renaissance, a central planned building, which is called Il Tempietto, the little temple. How temple-like is that? About as far as you can go. This was designed by Bramante. It actually is simply a martyrial chapel that marks the place where St. Peter was crucified, allegedly, on this spot. It's a beautiful, it's an exquisite little building that shows this adoption of Greco-Roman forms for Christian architecture. Or another very famous building. This one was begun by Bramante. This is the new St. Peter's. This is the one you can go and visit that replaced the old one that I showed you. And it did so beginning in 1506 at the behest of Pope Julius II, who believed that he was the proper one to replace this 1,300-year-old building and build a new one. I don't think the review board of Rome was working on that day. So he builds a basilica, which is based on the Renaissance ideas that we see in the Renaissance, but he doesn't finish it. It takes a long time, and it grows, it gets bigger. Michelangelo is the one who basically finishes the central part of it, and then another architect at the end of the 16th century. Finally, Bernini puts this great piazza, and together they create the most enormous church the world has ever seen. One that impresses anyone who has been to Rome. I'm sure some of you out there have been, and you have been impressed, I know. No one fails to be. Part of the meaning behind this church has to do with that impression. That is, it was finished during the Counter-Reformation, and the popes of the later 16th century and early 17th century understood that the value of this church was not just in marking St. Peter, but it was rhetorical. That is, this church would proclaim the truth of Catholic Christianity by its size and by its splendor. You can prove that by actually reading the documents of the Council of Trent, which explicitly tell us that's what you are to do with art. That is, you are to change people's minds and to convince them of the true Catholic Church. So the splendors of this building, the works that are inside, the dome, the light that filters down, and the great canopy over St. Peter's tomb, which is 100 feet high. We're looking down at a service in process. The Pope's down there somewhere. And we see that this clearly is an evocation of a temple. In fact, of course, the spiral columns, we call those Solomonic columns. They imitated the columns that were in old St. Peter's that were allegedly copied after Solomon's temple. We're not sure how they came up with that idea of the spiral column, but that's what they call them. So, another temple. Well, all right, there we are. But St. Peter's Basilica plays a very important role. I'm going to make an audacious claim. It is because of St. Peter's that we had a Reformation and we have Protestantism. Well, maybe that's exaggerating a little bit. If you think back, if you remember when Luther nails his theses on the door, one of the complaints, you know, one of the major complaints was about indulgences. And what were the indulgences for? The building of St. Peter's, right? Which Luther himself says, and they're collecting these for the building of the Pope's church in Rome, which is a meager thing. So there it is, right? People were angry that their tax dollars, or well, worse than that, were going for the Pope's big project. Well, all right, what about the Reformation and church architecture? It's a complicated story. We're not going to go into it in any detail tonight. In fact, I'm not going to go over, as Mark had said, the Lutheran examples at all. We'll focus on Calvinism. The first thing that we note in Protestant Reformation architecture is that there's some destruction rather than construction. Rejecting what they consider to be idolatry, they began to destroy all the images, relics, paintings, sculptures, stained glass, other works of art, objects and furnishings within the church that were representing false doctrines were torn down. Choir stalls, screens separating the clergy and the congregation were taken down. Images of saints, especially Mary, altars, of course, and altar pieces. We could call this the purging of the temple, to make an analogy with Christ, but that wouldn't be adequate. We'd actually have to say that it is ultimately the rejection of the temple. That the church would be considered a temple at all is something that will be repudiated by most Reformed theologians and ministers. Images. The priesthood, relics, and altars are to be taken out. The things that make the church like a temple are to leave and to be replaced with the things that make possible the elements of worship, the word, the sacraments, and prayer, and congregational singing. And so it's these appointments, which we'll go into in a little more detail tomorrow, that become the language of rebuilding, reconstructing what the church is. There are two things to look at here historically. There are the churches that are purged and then rebuilt, or renovated, and then of course there are some new churches that that are built in the Reformation. Not many. It's hard to find a strong history of new church building in 16th century Europe. More in 17th, and of course many more in the 18th. In the 16th century, though, we have documents of churches that were built and now have been destroyed, especially for Huguenot churches. We know that there were many churches, except that here we have another problem. This is a twist, and this is a conundrum which hasn't been satisfactorily solved to my knowledge. The Huguenots called their meeting house churches temples. So there's our temple, Temple, which explicitly would tell you that you're not looking at a Catholic church, but at a Protestant meeting house, we would call it. But they use the word Temple. There are several explanations as to why this is, but none, as far as I know, has been completely agreed upon. So we have here a Temple at Lyon, a very well-known and important city of 1566. It apparently was a circular building, a central plan. It had a gallery. It had seating in it, fixed seating. This was a novelty in the history of church architecture. My students often ask when I show them these cathedrals, where do people sit? They didn't sit. They stood, or they brought their own chairs. But now we have seats because these people are going to sit and listen to a guy who's speaking from a pulpit. That was a known typology in a central location, in an otherwise relatively unadorned place. These are ordinary people in congregation together, complete with dogs, all the members of the family, looking like a rather secular, ordinary, and utilitarian place. Or another example would be probably the finest, the most monumental of the French Reformed churches, would be this one, designed by the great architect Solomon de Brosse, who had worked for the Queen and was a Protestant, designed the temple at Charenton. That is effectively the Paris temple, which was not allowed to be in Paris, but outside of Paris. And what he built is a kind of basilica with two gallery levels, obviously designed to house the maximum number of people with the speaker, the minister in the center in a pulpit. Here's a plan. You can see he probably was looking at ancient treatises on Roman basilicas. No apses this time, just a very simple but elegant building. Well, we do have some examples of Protestant churches that were remodeled. Of course, you can go see some of these, or you can look at the paintings of people like Peter Sonderdam and see the great St. Bavo Church in Haarlem, and you can see that its walls have been whitewashed and that that all images have been excised and that a great pulpit has been placed there. You also see, if you look at Sonderdam's many paintings, that the church is explicitly a secular place. It is an ordinary thing, which is a thing of beauty, not of ugliness, but an ordinary thing nonetheless. Or you can look at new-built churches in Holland, such as the several Amsterdam churches by Hendrik de Keyser. You can see here the South Church, the Zuiderkerk, which is essentially a reinterpretation of a Gothic church made classical with the orientation changed, the seating changed, and a great tower. Or the Westerkerk. Notice, these two churches are not called St. Mary's or called any other highfalutin name. They're called the West Church and the South Church. Again, indicating their lack of sacredness, I suppose. Keep getting that message, don't we? Well, we could tell the same story in England about how churches were changed, and we will refer to this tomorrow somewhat. I'm not going to show you what happened. Of course, the churches in England have, there's iconoclasm. It's a very complicated story because of what happens in England. But there's one church that comes to us from the 17th century that stands out as very important. This is the Church of St. Paul's in Covent Garden, designed in 1631 by the great architect Inigo Jones. This is a Puritan building. It's never taught that way. This building is in all the books because it's so important. But it's always missed. I just looked this up one day and found it out. It was built for Sir John Russell, the Earl of Bedford, the fourth Earl of Bedford, who is one of the was a staunch Puritan, one of the founders of the Saybrook Colony in Connecticut, and who hired, this was his chapel and his private development, who hired several Puritan pastors, including Thomas Manton. This was his church before the Laudian reforms came in. So this was a center of Puritan activity, and it is a high-style, and guess what, temple-like building. It's got a porch. It's got a freestanding porch. Here's Alberti's temple, and now it's really like a temple. It's closer to IPC and the many churches that we know than anything that had existed before. It's also very plain. There is no symbolism. There are no images on it. There's a clock. And there was a weather vane, apparently, as well. And that's it. And the inside was equally simple. I'm not going to show it to you because it's not anything like what it was, and we're not even quite sure what it was like. I'll say a little bit more about it next tomorrow. Of course, English architecture and the Protestant English architecture is better known to us from the Restoration era, and especially in the work of Christopher Wren. For example, the great church of St. Paul's, the flagship church of the Church of England. This is a temple. It's also a building that consciously is meant to shout out to Rome and Paris that the English are great people too, even though they're Protestants. And very much imitates them and their traditions. Where Wren, I think, is most interesting, though, is in his parish churches. You know, the Great Fire of 1666 provided a lot of work for Wren. He worked on about 50 new church or rebuilt churches after the fire had wiped out some 70 churches or so. A lot of churches in a little area. Right? And he basically reinvented what the English church type is. Unfortunately, very few of these remain, at least as they were. St. Stephen's Walbrook is a good example of a Wren church. It's pretty innovative. We can't categorize it clearly. It's a central plan building with a dome that uses temple-like objects. It did have a large pulpit. It had the tablets of the law and other things that Puritan churches would have, but it's a higher style. It was also, as all of Wren's churches, meant to be an auditorium. That's what he called it, a place for speaking. Here are a couple of other Wren churches. You can see that he's well known for the spires that he developed. We can see what happens to Wren, though, in his followers, Nicholas Hawksmoor's, Christchurch Spitalfields, who worked for Wren, goes out on his own and builds many more London churches, including this one, where there's a greater incorporation of the spire with the simple basilican hall. And how about that, right? Just take one more step and you can find a most remarkable combination. Put the spire in through the roof of the temple and attach it to a large box, not a basilica, a large auditory meeting hall, and you come up with a church that's familiar to all of us. Even if you haven't seen it, it's familiar to you. This is the model church for hundreds, maybe thousands of churches. St. Martin in the Fields, next to the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. Designed, curiously, ironically, by Sir James Gibbs, a brilliant architect, and a Scot, and a Catholic. But he is going to be one of the major forces in Protestant church architecture because of this church and his book that he published that American colonists bought and used. Speaking of American colonists, let's now go over the waters and see what's happening in New England, where the Puritans who left, as St. Paul's Covent Garden is being built, there's the Great Migration. And those coming over are amongst the staunchest Calvinists we know, holding to the teachings of the Reformers, holding to the teachings of John Calvin, who in one of his sermons says, "Where is the temple of God? There is Jesus Christ who fills the world. He is with us. He who dwells in our souls, our God, does us the honor of appointing us to be sanctuaries and temples." And so the New England Puritans said, "So why are we building buildings that are called this when God dwells in us?" The rhetoric here matches what we have in the buildings. There were several. This was actually, I was reading, claimed not to be true, but the author I was reading is wrong. Right? There were several who said, "You should not call a place for Christian worship a church." Richard Mather in England said, "There's just no ground from Scripture to apply such a trope as church to a house for public assembly." So they would refuse to call these churches. They would call them meeting houses, and they built them to look like what they called them. These were the largest houses in town, usually. They were sometimes rectangular and often square, and there's some discussion as to where that form comes from. But nevertheless, that would be another distinguishing feature. Unfortunately, I can't show you many from the 17th century because they've all disappeared except for one. The Hingham Meeting House, which comes from the end of the century and was dramatically modified anyway, so it's not even quite the way that it was, is the one example of a 17th century meeting house in Massachusetts. A square with a hipped roof and a cupola, which is 18th century, that was added, and the fancy door was added as well. It was much plainer before. The interior is still quite plain. It's basically a box, an oblong rectangle with a large pulpit and box pews, and a great open truss ceiling like the Franciscans. It's the open truss ceiling that gives it the name the Old Ship Meeting House, because that's what people thought of when they looked up. Well, that, of course, leads to some development, and this will get us back to where we started, but not quite to the end. The meeting house becomes ever so much so slowly more refined. We can see here in the meeting house in Farmington, a rather fine clapboard house with a spire that dates to a few years after the Brattle Street Church, which I had shown there, attached to that spire. So now meeting houses can have a little decoration. A much smaller spire incorporated into the building is a building you can go see on Saturday afternoon, driving a little over an hour south of here at the Midway Meeting House. Or see what happens to that when we move forward and we find the influence of some of the English copybooks and a desire to create a little more refinement in Puritan architecture. So, for example, the Bennington First Congregational Church of 1806 has classical temple-like features to what was the meeting house. Or, even more, the Center Church on the Green in New Haven, the First Congregational, which was designed by Asher Benjamin, who had written a book and published images of churches like this. This, of course, is St. Martin in the Fields, again, revived, even more finely built, I think, than St. Martin in the Fields. And, of course, in the same category, the very church where we're meeting is in that same time period and of that same ilk. Another child of the St. Martin in the Fields tradition. This is the tradition we all, some of us, grew up with, right? This is the church that we say, this is the church, this is the steeple, and then we look for the people. Right? This is our image of what we think of when we think of a church. And this is something of its heritage, of its lineage. Well, it wasn't long before there was criticism of the classical steepled church. I mean, it was about the time when they started doing it, in fact. And the criticism went in different ways. For many, the pagan temple that the meeting house had become was not an appropriate place to worship a holy God. It was not a spiritual enough place. So there's one of our ironies. The temple wasn't spiritual enough. And so there were some who believed that that a more spiritual form was necessary, and Gothic revival was brought into the equation. This was part of a theological and liturgical movement dedicated to restoring transcendence to Christian worship. Its impact was huge. Thousands of churches in the 19th and 20th centuries are built in this manner, and we'll say more about it next time. Trinity Church in Manhattan, 1846, is a great example, an early example by Richard Upjohn. Or also in Manhattan, St. Thomas Church, 1913, we're in the 20th century, by Ralph Adams Cram. I've got to bring Cram up. Here's the connection. Ralph Adams Cram, one of the greatest Gothic revival architects ever, is also the guy who built this room and this building, thankfully not in the Gothic style. He was, it's surprising, because he was almost rabid in his desire for spiritual space. He wrote a book called Church Building, in which he said, first of all, a church is a house of God, a place of his earthly habitation, wrought in the fashion of heavenly things, a visible type of heaven itself. And he goes on, but I won't. The church was a temple for Cram. Well, this desire for spirituality is parallel. It goes into the 20th century. I'm to the present day. It's still being done. But, of course, the 20th century conjures up with many the rise of modern architecture, the rise of modernism. Let me say, modernism of the kind that you study in seminary is not unrelated to modernism of the kind that we study in architecture schools. Parallels I won't develop very much here, but it's worth noting this. There is a new approach to architecture altogether. Now, modernism in architecture is generally associated with rationality, with simplicity, with the reduction of ornament, and with the secular. To this day, people talk about modernism as the advent of the secular and the decline of a spiritual and a Christian society. It may be a decline of Christian society, but it's not a decline of the spiritual. The more that I study, and others have said this too, spirituality is a major theme amongst modernists, most if not all modernists. Spirituality is the other side of a coin. People were surprised when they saw Le Corbusier designing this famous, probably the most famous modernist church of the 20th century at Longchamp, a pilgrimage church that replaced one destroyed in World War II. What Corbusier has done here, he's given us a building that we don't know what to do with. Here is an odd thing. It's not a basilica. It's not a central planned thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's a thing which is wholly other. And if that resonates with you, that idea is there, right? The idea of the holy, something which is inherently a spiritual place. No one's gotten a satisfactory rational explanation as to how he achieved these forms or what they mean. The interior is even more remarkable with stained glass and these enormously thick walls and the sloping surfaces of the ceiling and the walls. It's this place of transcendence. It was meant to be a place to have a transcendent experience. And that idea is traceable throughout much of modernist church architecture. Let me bring you into the 1980s. The Japanese architect Tadao Ando, whose Church of Light is seen here, where he says that the light is allowed to seep in to form almost magically, it's not that magic, through the concrete, the cross. But the attempt there is to create a spiritual space. Now, to put this in some context here, this is something I find really, really interesting. It's not just religious buildings. It's not just churches that have this religiosity about them with the modernists. For example, the landmark modernist building that many of you recognize, Frank Lloyd Wright's Guggenheim Museum in Manhattan in 1959, is a building that's been praised for several reasons. One is this building represents or embodies the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, better than any museum ever had. Or this church reflects the spirit of the genius architect who was nearly deified by some of his fans and certainly by himself. But more importantly, Hilla Rebbe, who was working for the Guggenheims, was actually the client. She was a great collector. It was her idea. And she ordered Wright in building this. She said, "What I want a temple of the spirit. That's what this is. It's a place to have an encounter with the holy, and the encounter was with the art, which was holy. This is the temple which contains the new god." There are countless more examples of that. Let me bring you to the end of the 20th century. Another Guggenheim, they start reproducing. This Guggenheim in Bilbao is one of the most famous buildings of the end of the century by Frank Gehry. It's been praised for many reasons, but if you read the criticism, the critics are not going to tell you how well it functions or how proportionate it is or anything. Mostly they're going to start talking spiritual talk. They're going to start telling you how, as the guy from the New York Times said, finally I feel like a human being. Or another critic who said that it was both divine and human. It was spiritual and sensuous. That's what they find in these spaces. And it's this drive for spirituality that is driving architecture, and I think many who are working in high-style modern architecture. Christ did not enter a man-made sanctuary. He entered a heaven, heaven itself, to appear for us in God's presence. So, Owen asks, what can be more glorious than this, namely, that the whole spiritual worship of the gospel performed here on earth at the right hand of the throne of majesty of God, and yet under his conduct we have faith, we have by faith an entrance into the presence of God. So, says Owen, how can we improve or embellish this kind of worship? He admonishes temple builders of today. Does our worship of God gain anything lavishly out of the bag for beautifying it? Will it compare with this glory of the worship of the gospel that is carried on under the conduct and administration of this glorious high priest? No. For Owen, the answer is, the worship of God is not of man's finding out, but it is of his designation, who is the wisdom of God. It is not taught by human wisdom, nor is it attainable by human industry, but by the wisdom and revelation of the Spirit of God. It is in every way divine and heavenly in its rise, in its discovery, and so becoming the greatness and holiness of God. For what doth please God, God himself is the sole judge. If anything set itself up in competition with it for beauty and glory, it will be found out to be engaged in a very unequal contest at the last day. So words worth thinking about for any architect, right? So that leaves us, at the close, it leaves us with a question. I suppose the question you have. So, all right, given that, what do we do? What do we build? What kind of architecture should we have? Here are some possibilities, right? We can build a kind of temple. We can build a kind of meeting house. Well, we have some models from history leaning in one direction or the other. We can look to those models. We can look to contemporary models. I'd say we should look as hard as we can at everything we know, and I'm not going to tell you what we should do. We'll develop it more tomorrow in the various talks that we have.